From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from the Upper Castro.
East Oakland.
Lake Mary, Oakland, what's poppin'?
Me and my husband are from Berkeley, California.
Coming up, we'll talk with San Francisco Supervisor Aaron Peskin about why he thinks San Francisco's sanctuary city status is worth $1 billion, literally.
If they were to cut funding to cities that supported same-sex marriage, which of course is now the law of the land, we would stand up for those San Francisco values.
Then we'll hear from a Buddhist congregation in San Francisco that was a target of racism in the past. It's now trying to expand beyond its Japanese identity.
I don't think it'll survive if we just keep the small Japanese community.
A new story from the spiritual edge. Those stories and more are coming up today on Cross Currents. When Donald Trump is inaugurated as President of the United States on January 20th, part of his 100-day action plan is to block federal funding to sanctuary cities. San Francisco received about $1 billion in federal funds last year. Berkeley, Oakland, and San Jose also stand to lose funding. San Francisco supervisors defiantly passed a resolution last month stating, quote, "No matter the threats made by President-elect Trump, San Francisco will remain a sanctuary city." Aaron Peskin is supervisor for District 3, a district which includes one of the largest foreign-born populations in the city. He's the chair of the Government Audit and Oversight Committee. KALW's Hanat Baba spoke with him about what possible federal budget cuts could mean for San Francisco.
So what does it mean, first, that San Francisco is a sanctuary city?
It is not a uniquely San Francisco idea. It dates back to the 1980s. Refugees were streaming north to the United States, and if returned, faced uncertain, if not deadly, futures. But what it really means is that generally, these jurisdictions don't use municipal funds to enforce national immigration laws. And usually, these jurisdictions forbid police or municipal employees to inquire about a person's immigration status. That simply is what the notion of sanctuary city is about.
Donald Trump has pledged not only to immediately deport millions of immigrants once he takes office in January, he's also said he will strip sanctuary cities and counties of all federal funding. How seriously is San Francisco taking that threat?
Oh, we're taking it very seriously. And it's obvious everything is very uncertain at this point. First of all, Mr. Trump has already backed away from many of the inflammatory, outrageous promises he made during the campaign. And only time will tell, but we should prepare ourselves. In San Francisco, that could mean as much as $1 billion, about a tenth of our enormous, almost $10 billion budget. Currently, we receive about $478 million in the current year budget from the United States of America. And we also receive close to $1 billion, about $915 million from the state, much of which is federal money. So if you add it all together, we're somewhere in the $1 billion range. If you look at the past Republican Congresses, there have been various measures, none of which have seen the light of day, that would have stripped cities like San Francisco up to $20 million, which, while that would be an unfortunate impact, is something that we could absorb. If we had catastrophic budget cuts of $1 billion, we would have to adjust to that. I mean, this is obviously we don't want to suffer federal budget cuts, but I think that the government is united, all of the members of the board, the mayor of San Francisco, in sticking up for one of San Francisco's fundamental San Francisco values, which is sanctuary city, in the same way that if they were to cut funding to cities that supported same-sex marriage, which of course is now the law of the land, we would stand up for those San Francisco values.
So let me just read some of the programs in San Francisco that are at risk. Just to understand where this money goes, Department of Public Health gets about $68 million directly from the federal government. The police department gets $2.8 million from the federal government. Public Works, $22 million. SFO, the airport, $30 million. The fire department, $1.9 million. Homeless housing and shelter, $38 million. $6.5 million.
And many other departments get money as well. The San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency gets millions of dollars of federal money. The district attorney's office gets some almost $3 million of federal money. So yeah, these cuts would ripple through virtually every department in city government.
So what are some of the responses then that San Francisco has? City Attorney Dennis Herrera is looking into maybe suing the federal government. There's talk about possibly turning California into a sanctuary state, the whole state. What are you talking about?
So all of these things are uncertain and will roll out in the months ahead. Obviously, we can avail ourselves of the judicial process. This is going to be many years in the making. None of this is going to happen overnight. This is going to require congressional action. And San Francisco knows how to fight. We've got a great municipal attorney's office, and we have a very good district court. Federal District Court, the Ninth Circuit remains a liberal bastion that represents the five Western states in the United States judicial system.
You're sounding very hopeful.
So, look, we have to stay the course. We are not going to give up our tough, fought-for values that make San Francisco the envy of the liberal world, and we're not going to negotiate with terrorists. We're going to stick to our principles, and we're going to have to make tough decisions, and those decisions are going to have real impacts on real people, and we're all going to be in it together.
Mm. So if we frame this in a larger context of how the San Francisco budget is looking going into 2017, how are the books doing?
San Francisco voters have really been willing to fund the causes that make San Francisco so special. Mm-hmm. There was an exception to that on this ballot. One proposition, Proposition K, which was a regressive presumptuous.
You're the only supervisor who came out against it.
Well, no, actually, there were three supervisors who voted against putting it on the ballot. Myself, Supervisor Kim, and Supervisor Yee voted against putting it on the ballot. The mayor's office actually chose to balance our budget on a tax that was not going to be brought to the voters until many months later in November. And the voters profoundly rejected that regressive tax. That tax would have raised the local sales tax by 0.75%, a 0.75% increase to our sales tax. And it's a regressive tax. I was the only member of the board who voted against the budget on the theory that it was being balanced by a tax the voters had not yet voted on. And indeed, they rejected it. And there are a number of alternatives that are out there, including the vehicle license fee. You may recall that Governor Schwarzenegger actually catapulted into office by getting rid of our decades-old vehicle license fee. And San Francisco has the ability, through a vote of our people, to bring that back. Mm-hmm. And those funds could be spent not only on transportation, but on human services as well. I have a lot of confidence in the San Francisco community and in the voters of San Francisco. And I think that the voters of San Francisco want to protect what makes San Francisco so special and unique and the envy of the world.
But they also want public works and they also want a good airport. And they also, you know, the fire department, homeless housing. This is core to life.
Absolutely. And let me say, look, As somebody who served on the board when we had a $6 billion budget and now serves on the board when we have a $10 billion budget that provided many, many services with a 27,000 person workforce that's now grown to almost 31,000, I think that we can actually tighten our belt and do more with less if we have to. We are at our best when we are under pressure. And I think that San Francisco employees and San Francisco citizens will rise to the occasion if these draconian cuts come down. It has really brought many of us together. I mean, the board and the mayor stood together 2 weeks ago, unified in our commitment to not back down and not be bullied by the new president-elect. And I think that will continue. And I think it's going to make us stronger together.
Finally, what are you most concerned about under the new administration?
I actually think it is much larger than the office of the president. I'm actually as or more concerned about a Tea Party Congress that will slowly, over the next number of years, erode some of the most profoundly important welfare state laws, whether it's Medicaid, whether it is Social Security, whether it's the Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare. And that is my biggest profound fear.
That's San Francisco Supervisor Aaron Peskin. He spoke with KALW's Hanat Baba. Now we'd like to hear from you. Do you support San Francisco's sanctuary city status? Why or why not? Call with your thoughts at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. We'd like to share your ideas on the air. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Julie Kane, and for Hanat Baba. Historically, the Japanese are another immigrant population that face significant difficulty in being accepted in the U.S. In San Francisco, people of Japanese heritage experienced significant oppression due to race. Against that backdrop, the Buddhist Church of San Francisco was born more than 100 years ago. Now, it's encountering a different kind of threat, one that's common among churches all over America. Church membership is down. There are exceptions, but mostly compared to, say, the 1970s, a lot of people just aren't interested in religion. And if you're a church, that's a problem. There are bills to pay and activities to fund. So leaders of the Buddhist Church of San Francisco in Japantown are getting creative, rethinking how they can appeal to new members. It's tricky. With religion, the form, that is, the customs and how you present yourself, matters. KALW's Judy Silber tells us how the church is looking to the future in this story from The Spiritual Edge. The Buddhist Church of San Francisco is gray and drab on the outside. But inside, past the sanctuary pews, is a dizzying sight. Gold leaf is everywhere. There's an elaborate, large bowl for incense offerings, and five ornate altars pay tribute to the Buddha and other people instrumental to this tradition with roots in Japan. It's a Sunday, and the Buddhist Church of San Francisco is holding a special memorial service to honor all those connected with the congregation who have died. Most people here are of Japanese ancestry. Before the service, several women gather in the lobby speaking Japanese. In the kitchen, others prepare for the event. Junko Nario Lo is a longtime member.
Well, I've been coming since probably since I was in the fifth or sixth grade of grammar school. I feel involved with the church community, and I like the fellowship.
The Buddhist Church of San Francisco, or BCSF, is a haven for the city's Japanese American community and has been since 1899 when it was founded. For a long time, it's been a largely insular community. But now, among many members, there's a sense that it's time to open up and become a more multicultural congregation.
I think we do need to expand and be more encompassing and be involved in the whole citywide community. I don't think it'll survive if we just keep the small Japanese community.
Jean Fukunaga agrees.
Keep the church growing, you know, and expanding the membership if we can.
Though called a church, this is actually a temple with roots in a Japanese tradition called Jodo Shinshu. In Japan, Jodo Shinshu is the most popular school of Buddhism, but here in the States, it's hardly known.
The Japanese immigrants who came to work as laborers starting in the late 19th century encountered a lot of racism. Their religion, Buddhism, was a target of prejudice. The oppression continued through World War II. One of the oldest congregants is Hiroshi Kashiwagi. He knows firsthand the struggles Japanese Americans have faced.
There was a fence with guard towers, and you couldn't leave. It was in Northern California, near the Oregon border.
Kashiwagi was a young man when he was released from the World War II internment camp at Tule Lake. In this crowd, the topic of the camps comes up easily.
It's important. It's really shaped my life, the rest of my life. And I was about 25 when I came out.
It's influenced the path of Buddhist Church of San Francisco. For example, its name, calling itself a church. During the war, leaders of the Jodo Shinshu community held a meeting at an internment camp in Utah. This is Reverend Ronald Kobata.
And during that time, I guess the leaders met and thought about what to do when the war ended and so forth. And they adopted the name Buddhist Churches of America, thinking that would make our community seem less alien or foreign.
Other temples in the network followed suit, using the church designation. Kobata, who is a third-generation Japanese-American, attended the San Francisco temple as a kid in the 1950s. He remembers that instead of straw mats for sitting, as you'd find in Japan, there were chairs, and later pews. As it still is today, the main service was on Sunday, with an organ, like in church.
Causes and conditions for, you know, how the community developed initially, just the practical need of the ethnic, cultural community to kind of insulate itself.
But today, the Buddhist Church of San Francisco finds itself in different circumstances. Racism still exists in the U.S., but the Japanese-American community is more assimilated. It's less a target.
Now the causes and conditions in the West are becoming such that, you know, Buddhism is beginning to open up beyond any ethnic cultural borders. And so that's really encouraging.
Encouraging because it means BCSF has a chance to draw in a new crowd, one that extends beyond its current small shin Japanese base. And Kobata says it has to if it's to survive. The city's Japanese community is shrinking, there's a lot of intermarriage, and fewer young people are interested in religion. But Kobata is optimistic.
The sense of identifying as Buddhist is starting to become hip. Just the idea of Buddhism seems to associate this idea of wisdom, compassion, and so forth. So there's a certain basic admiration, appreciation for what Buddhism represents in people's minds.
So Kobata wants to ride the wave of Buddhism's current popularity. He wants to introduce new customs, not native to Shin, but with proven track records, like meditation.
Noticing your posture, sitting upright with dignity, body like a mountain, breath like the wind. We're not trying to control the breath. We're simply watching the breath as it flows in and out.
In the sanctuary, Assistant Minister Leo Jocelyn is giving meditation instructions. While meditation is not an inherent part of the Jodo Shinshu religion, it is why about 15 people are here, seated in a circle with their eyes closed.
100 years ago, our flesh was soil. The blood in our veins was water. In the oceans, water evaporating, water coming down as rain, breathing breath like the wind.
This sustained focus on the breath, it's a critical piece of Tibetan Buddhism and Zen, or the more secular type of Buddhism found at places like Spirit Rock in Marin. But not so for Shin.
Namo Amida Buddha. Namo Amida Buddha. Namo Amida Buddha. Namo Amida Buddha.
Shin Buddhism centers around a practice called the Nembutsu, which is the chanting of one phrase.
Namo Amida Butsu.
Namo Amida Butsu. It means to take refuge in the Buddha. In this case, the Buddha is thought of not as the person who achieved enlightenment, but almost as a higher power, a source of immeasurable wisdom and compassion. You don't have to be in a monastery or temple to say the Nembutsu. You can say it anywhere, at any time.
this is very metaphorical, but the Amida Buddha, for me, represents the very deepest part of ourselves, the life force that pervades the entire universe.
Jocelyn is half white and half Japanese. But when he came to the Buddhist Church of San Francisco, he wasn't looking for a Japanese temple, just a convenient place to meditate. To bring meditation to his congregation, Reverend Ronald Kobata had to overcome a sense of guilt.
Getting beyond some sense of obligation or loyalty to the form, you know, the notion that we don't do that. And so this is, you know, how I come to accept that, you know, I'm part of a tradition, a form, a religion. But the whole idea is to get beyond it and to see that it's a way of bringing us or connecting us to the spirit, or I'd like to use the term heart.
This emphasis on the heart is working. The temple isn't overflowing by any means, but these days it's a more mixed group. That includes people of Japanese heritage who either lost their connection to Shin or didn't grow up with it at all. It also includes people with no Japanese blood. For example, Elaine Donlin came to the temple for a friend's funeral 15 years ago. It had been her third funeral in a month.
And this one was such a celebration. There was just so much joy and laughter and beauty, and it was so profound.
She was touched and never left. She's now a minister's assistant. She leads a once-a-month loving-kindness meditation and a growing LGBTQ members group.
I love this temple. I love just the physicalness of it. It's so beautiful, right? And so I would like to see it be sustained. But, you know, there's something interesting happens when a tradition, regardless of whether it's a Buddhist tradition or whatever type of religious tradition, the teachings become codified and then institutionalized, right? And then they become very static. And so what I love about Buddhism is that everywhere Buddhism went, it impacted the culture and the culture impacted it. And so there's that idea of impermanence. Everything is changing. So our tradition needs to change. That I do know. The tradition will change. It is changing.
May this meritorious truth be shared equally with all, together raising the mind of enlightenment and awakening to a realm of serenity and joy. Namo Amida Butsu. Namo Amida Butsu. Namo Amida Butsu.
The Buddhist Church of San Francisco will continue to evolve. So far, it's not clear how big of a difference the changes will make. But Kobata says while temple membership isn't growing, it's also not shrinking. That's a strong step for an historic congregation with a practice of survival. In San Francisco, I'm Judy Silber for Cross Currents. That story was reported for KALW's project, The Spiritual Edge. Check out the new website for more stories that take you beyond belief at spiritualedge.org. You've been listening to Cross Currents. Today's team includes Jeremy Dalmas, Leela Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Olivia Henry, Jürgen Klemm, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, James Rollins, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, Andrew Stelzer, Claire Strempel, and Beatrice Thomas. The show is engineered by Chris Hoff. Line producer was Liza Veal. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet.
Wait, wait, oh, I wanna look at this more. Wait, wait, I wanna look at that more. Wait, wait.
Before there was punk, there was the Bay Area's Jonathan Richman, who you're hearing now. Richman is touring with his first new album in 6 years. You can hear him at the Great American Music Hall in San Francisco on Thursday. Doors open at 7 p.m.
For Cross Currents, I'm Julie Kane. Tierras de la mano, tierras de la mano, por la fiesta de este mundo. Wait, wait, I wanna see this. Wait, wait, I wanna look at that. This. Wait, wait, oh, I haven't finished looking at that. Wait, wait.